Welcome to this Ledbury Poetry Festival event with Jacob Polley and Angus McNichol. A very big thank you to Arts Council England for sponsoring this event and indeed the whole festival, and a huge thank you to a very kind private donor who has also sponsored this event. Jacob Polley was born in Cumbria and he now teaches at Newcastle University. He is the author of three poetry collections, The Brink, Little Gods, and most recently, The Havoc, as well as the novel, Talk of the Town. Twice shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize, he has received the Geoffrey Faber Memorial Prize and the Somerset Maugham Award. His new book of poems, Jack Self, will be out in November. Angus McNichol is a poet in three languages, songwriter in folk and classical idioms, journalist, broadcaster, translator, and scriptwriter. A Borders-based skyman, poetry has taken him worldwide. He has held various literary fellowships and gained many awards for his writing. Fellow of the Association for Scottish Literary Studies, he holds an honorary doctorate in literature from Glasgow University. I'm not going to try the Gaelic pronunciations, but his Gaelic collections include The Avoiding, A Proper Schooling, Hymn to a Young Demon, and his English collections include Rock and Water. A new collection of poems in English is in preparation. His song lyrics have been set to music by some of Scotland's leading composers and recorded by wonderful singers. A collection of his songs should also appear soon. With no further ado, I shall hand over first of all to Jacob. Jacob's going to bring that up, I think, but yes, sorry. Yes, there will. This is also an English pen reading, so thank you. Thanks for reminding me. But I shall hand over to Jacob, and he will talk about that.
Great.
Jacob.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here again. It's always a pleasure for me to come to Ledbury. And Ledbury have been very supportive of kind of me over the years, so it's something I'm really grateful for. And I come back to the sun-dappled streets of Ledbury and always feel like I'm kind of coming back somewhere that I'm very happy to be. I'm going to do something now, which it's a really mixed blessing. It's something that I wish that I didn't have to do, and that's to speak a little bit about Emmanuel Azrat from Eritrea, and to read a little bit of his work. Ledbury Poetry Festival have partnered up with English Pen, and this is a literature and human rights charity that aims to defend writers' rights to freedom of expression. And they've teamed up to bring you poetry as protest. And this initiative has been set up to draw attention to writers believed to have been detained or otherwise persecuted in relation to their poetry. And throughout the festival, Ledbury poets will be reading the work of our imprisoned and persecuted colleagues around the world. You can see this is something I wish that I didn't have to do, because I wish people weren't imprisoned and persecuted, probably, obviously. Emmanuel Azrat from Eritrea, whose work I'm going to read in a minute, is one such poet. Emmanuel Azrat, an award-winning poet, critic, and editor-in-chief of Eritrea's leading newspaper, was arrested at his home in September 2001. And almost 15 years later, he continues to be held without charges or trial. So it's perhaps nice to dedicate my reading to Emmanuel this morning. And I'm just going to read a bit of one of his poems, just an extract, because it's quite long. So this is a poem by Emmanuel Azrat from Eritrea, still in prison. War's curse. Something growled, something boomed, invading the calm, it echoed, stuck. Where two brothers pass each other by, where two brothers meet, where two brothers join in the piazza of life and death, in the gulf between calamity and culture, in the valley of anxiety and peace Something boomed. Eviction. This is a poem written kind of, as it were, after a painting by Masaccio, the great painting of the eviction from the Garden of Eden. It's a painting in a fresco in Florence. Eviction. Barefoot, they've entered the outermost place. She covers her breasts. He hides his face. Behind them stands the light-filled, grey stone-arched city doorway. The unworked earth is parched. Their shadows lag and elongate, longing towards the shade. Everything waits to be suffered, as now the garden's streams and orchards lie outside their lives in dreams. He howls into his hands, her upturned foreheads smooth and white, her small mouths tearing wide. They are, after all, only adequate and flesh, and grieve at the easily understood threshold of grief, from where one, fully dressed and armed, shoes them indifferently into the west. A jar of honey. This is from my first book, The Brink, which, as you can see, is time has treated it well. Has anyone got The Brink? Great. I'm going to ask you to make an amendment in your copies. A jar of honey. You'll perhaps see. I'll ask you to strike out a line. If you could do it as I fail to read it, that would be great. A jar of honey. You hold it like a lit bulb, a pound of light, and swivel the stunned glow around the fat glass sides. It's the sun, all flesh and no bones, but for the floating knuckle of honeycomb. Potsherds. There's always a kind of odd thing. The thing that makes you write a poem or kind of sows a seed or just gives you a little hint that there might be something there that you might explore. I wrote this after seeing something on TV. Being a user of TV, a heavy user of TV, in order to relax. But even there, I couldn't fully relax. I saw an extraordinary program about. It was a kind of archaeological program about an archaeological dig on a beach, where they'd found. I love all this stuff. You know, 2,000 years of a kind of settlement, basically. And one of the things that was really striking was that these great pots were kind of still in place, obviously used as kind of, you know, they were kind of almost set into the floors of these little houses, you know, so they were almost used as kind of larders or shelves in themselves, you know. Potsherds. Dug into the floors of our houses beneath the sea. Our jars now hold no whisper of the cornfield, and only by their handles can the shapes and functions of our ewers be conjectured. Though the evidence of intact smaller pots fashioned for salt or precious spice, to weigh so sweetly in one hand, makes clear we variously contained as oils and alcohols, the desiccations of fish and flour, and in suspensions of brine and animal fat, only those parts of the world whose keeping required of us an art. I'm going to read a few poems from I've got a new book coming out in November. So I'm going to read a few poems from this book. It's called Jack Self. It's an odd book. It's a kind of a single story, really, told in poems about this character, Jack Self. And he has various... he's all the Jacks, you know? Jack Dore, Jack Spratt. So I'm going to read a few of these poems. The book kind of runs from his birth through to his friendship with a character called Jeremy Wren. All this, of course, will make perfect sense when you see the book in November. So hold on to these thoughts until then. Jack Spratt. Jack Spratt, who depends on strong drink and soft food, gives Jack shit, comprehends fearlessly by mouth, lacquering bricks and bottles with curatorial spit. Who watches Thomas Cat stalk the sliding light across the hearthrug on afternoons of his limited Jack span, none of which he can get back, not the suns and moons of it, not the crackling fur, lavender and turpentine smell of it, who mumbles his greens, his fists, the bars of his cage, whose one-piece suit isn't nightmare retardant, who is driven round and round in strangers' cars for comfort, who can achieve unawares, like Thomas Cat, aloof, only to be turned upon by those minted ladies he brought so low before him, whose face is reset hourly, whose mind is solid fear, whose trades are none and all the possible, who will come into anthracite, corbel, gasometer, throstle, who gnaws boot and book leather alike, who covets the onion wrapped in plain brown onion skin, whose small memory is a gift that makes the world over again when he wakes. Don't wake him. The goodies. Did you have goodies? You know, sweeties. Got any goodies? The goodies. One of the pleasures of kind of writing poems is... I was about to say one of the pleasures of writing poems is being able to write nonsense, you know? yeah, so maybe it is one of the pleasures of writing poems, but this is a kind of nonsense poem, I suppose. I was about to say I haven't written many nonsense poems, but there may be some people who would disagree with that. But, anyway, the goodies. Goody on you, goody sweet. Smell goody, goody touch. Goody butter, goody meat. Goody shoes on goody feet. A goody cake with six goody candles to yank the goody shadows round by their goody hair. Goody blow, goody out, goody fires, little spikes. Breathe goody in. Then pop the goody squeak face with a goody silver pin. No wishing it wouldn't be, or wasn't, or would better be. No wondering how so hard it hurts. Just two goody thumbs and a goody peephole for goody staring, goody weepers, standing goody by, in nothing but your goody suit with goody in your eye.
goody easy, goody true. Who's the goody? Goody you. Goody up the goody staircase with a goody creak to watch the moving pictures on the screen of goody sleep. No worrying the world to shreds, no going blind or blue, just a choice of face on waking from a dozen goody heads. Thank goody goody dust, do goody do, or you'll be trapped with one grey face your baddie pokes right through.
Hewitt. This is a kind of a poem about nicknames, really, about having a nickname, and the character in the poem is given this nickname. There's something about nicknames, you know, you kind of want a nickname, but you can want a nickname and then find that the nickname that you have is not the nickname that you want, you know. You might want a nickname like Big Man, used unironically, etc. A peewit is a lapwing, a kind of bird. I grew up on the Solway, Firth, and we would see lapwings, peewits, and they're known for their... they nest on the ground, and then they're known for pretending. You know, when a predator comes close, they pretend. They limp away. You know, they pretend that their wing is broken, and they lure away someone nearby, a predator from the nest by this pretending that they've got a broken wing. Peewit, a little one, drab. Barely skyborn, with nothing of the gut-unravelling acumen of the scavenger. This is Jack's self, limping across marshland, making a decoy of himself, piping up when the day goes dim, so close to the ground he's almost it. Small wonder Peewit is the name the other boys have given him. Not jackdaw, not rook. The gods of bracken and fly-tipped black plastic sacks will expose themselves to the pilgrim who has faith in the star at the centre of the crab apple, in the ditch full of frog spawn and the shed door hinged with spiders' webs. So it comes to pass for Peewit, whippy stick in his right hand, as he tramps the far-out lanes with those who had diminished him, a breeze starts to ratch in the dust. The foxglove jangles, his legs break, and he goes down, his eyes a white flutter in his head. The boys circle him where he fits, grinding his teeth so hard they sing. And when they heft him, heavier than he should be, his bird soul batters into him. They process so slowly, the lights all gone by halfway home, when Peewit's no longer between them has flown. And blank with terror, the boys go round and round in the dark and cold and are not ever found. In the book, Jack Self has a friend, Jeremy Wren, and they do lots of bits and pieces, including fishing, but they do it with night lines, so kind of fishing lines set across, you know, at night across a river or a stream. Night lines. But Jeremy Wren obviously shares a name with shares a surname with the architect Wren. Someone tell me the architect's name. Christopher, yes, thank you. Goodness me. Yeah, Wren shares this architect's name. Nightlines. A priest is a thing that you hit a fish over the head with. Have you seen them? It's like a club, like a truncheon. Nightlines. Jack Self and Jeremy Wren are setting nightlines in the kidney-coloured pool all the streams of England run into. Jack Self's fretting. All night the guiled will hang, their hooked lips mouthing into the waterworks and bloodstreams of all England. All night, gaffed, their bullion flexing, until Jeremy Wren bashes them at dawn with his hardwood priest. Wren, who says his grandad built the southern domes Jesus needed to stable his beasts, thinks Jack Self's a soft lad, a quick tear, a worry wit, and ties off another triple-barbed spinner. So Jack Self rolls up his jeans, takes one end of the nylon line looped to a tent peg and wades into the chuckling shallows. Slippery stoned, ice-cool fish path where no one has stood for 1,000 years. When Wren's not looking, Jack Self stamps his foot, and all the carp and sticklebacks, the perch and pike and bream, are shaken out of their gullible, muddy-minded dream. I'll maybe end with two ballads, one from Jack Self and one from the previous book. I hate saying my book, my previous book. It sounds it's like another person, really, you know. It's really odd. But anyway, you shouldn't do, should you? You should just very confidently go, my previous book. But anyway, I'll read two ballads, one from the book that's on its way and one from the one before. Or maybe I won't. I'm just looking at the clock. I might just read one. It's a bit fast. Oh, how nice of you. That's so kind. So I'll read the ballad from Jack Self, which is just called Jack O'Lantern. So you can hear in this book there are iterations of Jacks. Jack. Jack O'Lantern. Skip Jack. So this is Jack O'Lantern. And I meant to say as well, I'm doing a later this evening.
This is a plug.
Later this evening, I'm doing a musical kind of version of more of these Jack Self poems, some that you will have heard now and some others that I haven't read now. But I'm collaborating with someone called John Alder, a lovely, lovely man, and we're doing a kind of strange musical atmospheric version of Jack Self. So that's later tonight. If you'd be wonderful if and I'm this is with Gerda Stevenson as well, and so there's two musical events tonight. That was your plug. Jack O'Lantern. This poem kind of comes around about the middle of the book, and it's when things have kind of gone wrong for Jack Self and Jeremy Wren. Jack O'Lantern. The leaves are slimy yellow light, the years a sticky door, the wind bangs in the barest trees and shakes the apple core. No, again. The leaves are slime, the year a bloodshot eye, the trees the rooms of bedlamites with bars across the sky. The wind's inside the apple core, the moon bangs like a drum and no, again. The sky's a door, the year a slum, the wind a house of bedlamites with trees in every room, the leaves attached like leather straps and light a yellow spoon. The moon's beside the... No, again. The year breaks down the door. The leaves are shut inside the trees. The trees in apple cores. The wind bangs in the barest rooms of bedlam. No, again. The leaves are rooms, the no. The moons are no. The year a vein of narrow gold. The trees gold flakes, the leaves gold leaves. The wind a whiny no. Again, the rakes are brooms, the moon is skinned, and no again. The bedlamites have wedged the no again. The wind is bare, and yellow spoons are banging on the brain. The years wedged shut with apple cores, the no a leather stain. The slimy moon an open sore, and every room the same. And thank you. It's been so nice to be here again, and lovely to read with Angus McNichol. It's a great pleasure, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing him read, and very nice to see you all this morning. Langley Lane. This is another ballad. It's kind of based on there's a ballad called Lord Randall or Lord Ronald. There are various versions. There's a beautiful set version by Alastair Roberts, the wonderful Scottish folk musician. But anyway, this isn't that poem. This is a different poem, but it's kind of based on that old ballad, Langley Lane. It's a mother and son speaking. So the mother starts. And thank you again, so nice to be here. Langley Lane. Stand up straight, my son. Don't slouch. Mother, I'm not slouching. There's nothing you need hide from me. You know I don't like touching. A mother must, it's in my hands, to touch what's mine so briefly. To touch my son for one small proof that he's still strong and loves me. Mother, I wish you weren't at home and I could sit in peace. I'd hope to meet the dark alone and not to cause a fuss. My son, I'm bound to love no less the child who brings me pain. My son, what spreads across your shirt? You need not hide a stain. What I hide won't be undone, and I'd not see your face to spare myself the sight of one whose grief is my disgrace. Take a chair, my son. You're tired. Drink a glass of milk. You're up, you're down. Your brain's still soft. Your adulthood half built. You're pale, my son. You'll fade away. You need a bite to eat. Once I was young, and like you swayed unsteady on my feet. Mother, soon I'll get my rest, so while I can, I'll stand. My son, what's loose at your left wrist? What's spilling from your hand? Mother, my hand is full of shame. It's pouring from my heart. I've walked it in from Langley Lane, where trouble's known to start. If trouble starts, you've said to me, just turn and walk away. But Langley Lane's blind corner led to five who blocked my way. You're on our turf, one said, and spat. The youngest looking shoved me first. I shoved him harder back. He punched me in the chest. The leaves were still. The sun came out to scatter coins of light. And I saw gripped in his right fist a little silver spike. A spike at which I stared, surprised. A bloody silver spike at which he also stared, surprised. Our two boys' looks alike. The sun went in. A siren moaned. Clouds crawled across the blue. They grabbed my phone. I started home. What else was there to do? My son, you walked from Langley Lane. I walked from Langley Lane. I took small steps and often stopped to breathe around the pain. My son, you walked from Langley Lane. I walked from Langley Lane. I held myself to slow the stain and walked from Langley Lane. Thank you.
Martin Barr. Prachtig. De goeie kleurig, veil zich heen. Ik had het, is misje en tamaten nu van baard. Ark is eestrum. Anybody understand? Shall I go on to the next one? I should say, don't take it personally. The poem is called Banner, and it's an invitation rather than a stipulation, if you like. Banner, your voice crying, reveal yourself. Friend, I am the holy fool, the bard. Observe and listen. It's got a slightly Presbyterian tone to it, but that comes from my upbringing. And I'll read the one that follows it just to give you another wee taste of Gaelic. Gunenem. Get a hanguan socker and noch, hooksin a yoda or cheer, get a hilly fur and noch, gurishin matcha rishin china. Ha gaurig a chin, ha gallon a chin, and lissakin kun, ach, gaviller store and St. Hall. Nameless. Though the ocean is gentle, tonight we took the dinghy ashore. Though it's not cold tonight, we'll put a match to the fire. There's a winter coming. There's a storm coming. We don't know when, but that our store is in the barn. Reference was made to my name, and I do allow the poor, benighted, non-Gael to pronounce my name, Angus MacNicol, but those have the language of Eden. Call me Nurse MacNicol. Would you repeat after me? No? However, my parents, both native Gaelic speakers, went to the local registrar, a native Gaelic speaker, and told him my name, Nurse MacNicol. And those who have the eyesight good enough to see will see that he registered me as Angus Nicholson, which was the convention. It was, in a way, I suppose the same thing happened to the Scots language and the borders. The dialects of English treat them with disdain. Standard English was imposed upon us, not just in the schooling we had. I went to school a native Gaelic speaker. Native Gaelic speaking teacher, his job was to teach me English, and from then on my own language had no status in education until in secondary I could choose between French or Gaelic as a subject, and it was taught to native Gaelic speakers by a native Gaelic speaker through the medium of English. So, the fact that my reputation now is more based on my Gaelic poetry than on the English poetry I started with is one of life's little surprises. This was my first appearance in book form in a Gollancz, actually. Poets produced this Poetry Quintet. And this is a little poem in English. Autumn. She, being the youngest girl in the village, said, 30 winters is too long to wait. Next summer no one might come, and hitched up her skirt to a drunken fisherman behind the peat stack. I'll blame it on your beautiful eyes, she said, and the way you dance. I'll kind of weave between the languages. The poem, I must have shown it at an early stage to Philip Hobsbawm, who was, I left school at 16, had not a very good relationship with the education system, but then I started writing, and I noticed when I would pick up anthologies that virtually every poet in an anthology had an MA, or at least had some university qualifications. I thought, that's how you become a poet, you go to university. So I went back to education and got the necessary qualifications to go to Glasgow University, which I chose because it had at least three distinguished poets on the staff, Alex Scott in the Scots Language Department, Edmund Morgan, and Philip Hobsbawm, who had not too long before come up from... he'd actually come over from Belfast. And Philip established an organisation that he called The Group in Cambridge when he was an undergraduate, which had himself and a bunch of obscure fellow undergraduates like Edward Lucy Smith, Ted Hughes and others. Then he went to Belfast, and his group there, I had the privilege of meeting probably the best known of his Belfast group in Philip's flat in Glasgow, a certain Seamus Heaney. And he came to Glasgow and set up a group there, which I had the privilege of being a member of, alongside a bunch of obscure Scots poets like Liz Lochhead, Tom Leonard. Well, James Kelman's a novelist rather than a poet, and Alistair Gray. So, but Philip, at this stage, the anthology, the Collins book hadn't been published. I showed him a batch of poems, and probably they were workshopped, and he kept saying to me, go back to the divide. Write about what you know, write from your own experience and your own background. So I shall read in memory of Philip, I'll read The Divide. And it's a fictionalized version of, I suppose, what I grew up with. Old Donald has seen New York from seaward, spent a winter in Archangel, been broke in Valparaiso, has drunk till dawn with shanty blacks in Cape Town, smuggled liquor here to there, loved a dancing girl in Cairo, and has no regrets except that his bones are grown brittle, his muscles stiff, his eyes cloudy. The tramp he sailed for over 30 years went to the breaker's yard in 1948. Now he sits in his house by the shore, listening to the gulls, looking westward, reminiscing, waiting. His brother John lives inland, tending his score of lean black cattle, playing pibrochs on a chanter. He does not hear the crows prattle. Daily he cleans and polishes his father's bagpipes and never let these pipes play reels for dancers, but dreams he is the last MacCrimmon, lamenting the desolation of Borereig. Now, the MacCrimmons were the hereditary pipers to the Clan MacLeod in the Isle of Skye, and they had this college of piping, it was seen as in later years, but a place to which other pipers would come to learn the craft of piping from the MacCrimmons. So that's the reference there. I also occasionally dabble in the Scots language. I don't claim to be a speaker of Scots, but it's fun. Nowadays, of course, if you're stuck for a word, you Google it and all is resolved. But I was talking to somebody, I can't remember, was it last night or this morning, probably both, about being old enough to remember preferring the Carl Perkins version. Is there recognition of what I'm referring to? There's a few of you might qualify. No? Blue suede shin. The tram car sings its ain percussive sang o slow acceleration doon the old reed sandstained shuchs fae Ochenshuggle to Dalmuir. Dalmuir te Ochenshuggle, that ains were Gaelic fields, ain cried for Mary, ain for Rye, and knew their tenemented tunes, forut, ayont the stent ye ken, atween Dus Pertic and the Glesca Cross, baith hiding gid Brythonic roots. And that old shugly cor will tack your keely cousin and yoursel toward the shops, ye're arguing, ach, Haley doesn't matter, there's nae dissension about that. But sign he's saying, Presley's better, and your ain backspeak is, Perkins wrote the bloody sang, he surely kens best what it means and who to sing it. But listen to the blatter of the tram, transistors canny kempt be yon, aye, listen to the blatter of the tram. So there we are. Yes, I preferred the Carl Perkins version. What has history said? Now, there being a distinguished politician in the front row here, just to introduce a wee element of, I suppose, contemporary politics. Can you handle an epic? There's a poem called Poverty. Poverty is relative, says my cousin, the banker. I'll read another wee poem in English. For a young lady who's now 18, left school with a trophy and feeling very proud of herself, but this was written when she was 10. Her daughter, who's has Down syndrome, but was educated through the mainstream all the way through her education, and there's a wee footnote to this. My daughter asked me to write a poem about herself, her mother, the dog, a very large and very lively pup, and me, and the house. So here's Dancing Light for Galina, not quite 10. In this house there is a dancing light. She smiles like fire. Her words are pieces of the sun. So guard her weathers well, I tell myself. Please guard her weathers well. Mum's a silence here just now. She's out walking a bunch of bright black energy, still too much pup to stay at heel. They'll soon be back. We'll hear the sharp, clear breath at the door. And she, our lovely daughter, will be glad. She likes her world to be complete. I think, along with everyone else participating, invited to contribute to the 20 years of Ledbury Poetry Festival, edited by a certain Mark Fisher. So my contribution is a poem called Art, Lived, and it's in memorial John Bellany, who is a wonderful Scottish artist whom we had the privilege of knowing through Gerda's dad, actually. John was one of two or three people who became very good friends with Ronald Stevenson. But he died a number of years ago, so this is a memorial poem, I suppose. That he should go with brush in hand, engaged in dialogue with what had been mute canvas, seemed apropos. We might have wished the breath had held its measure longer. When a mind still hungering to tell another composition, still engaged in shaping, shading, realizing how the vital shifting substance of an exact place could be made new again, again, again. A sailor of harbors who knew all the stories of storms and stupendous plimsoll drowning catches his own kin had told. He believed in what he saw and drew it out in colors fierce and joyous. He knew how to lay it on thick, to stipple, stroke his pigments into lives and lived in patterns of tenement and trawler, drank deep from the well of changes, kept his vision true, spoke to the world until that final pause. His story cannot end. It's a poem called May, M-A-E, which has the wee kind of, what do you call it, the aphoristic phrase, I used to be snow white, but I drifted. Varishina, varishina, budusanche, hur fesha mach, hur claren tuhil, marker neach ruinye. Smerahurju, come up sometime, smerahurju and see me. Smerahunik, sul na hekne, the cholas, brilliachel, santulvik, nadiev. Stuhain, ik en deske te boerlug nam fakkelen mag eens op jarst. Ach va na lianan yang gashkir og kumir er ar dúlar an tóhil stu hén na te ógan trahínig fata da behe. Me, I used to be Snow White, but I drifted. Mary Jane, you were the one who broadcast sex to the world at large as an everyday thing. The way you said, come up sometime, the way you said, and see me, and how the mind's eye saw your bosomy appearance and the wink in your smile beckoning the thought, and how you went home from the stage, no word of cigarette or distilled yeast, to sit behind the desk where you toiled. You were too much for us, with your tongue of fires flirting with expectancy, with your laugh like an open window on things you never revealed, while you sowed in our minds the seeds of a thought that this was how you lived, among taut muscles and broad shoulders, as you sat behind that desk tapping the words out of their loom. But there were lovers like champions, young, handsome, on the world's stage, and yourself like a young girl through the long reach of your life. Now, I don't know whether I should cheekily just read the next one. Which has a reference to Black Angus. As I am still referred to north of the border. Nínach panigo mwyn bygein hín. A gieskach a nyter lín ar son fys, glach mi bech fo arenem, a hwrt gym benadr dy Don Juan a fan y nŵs dŵ na oge. Cap eisyn yn noch mysgahan go, ach bwg bân is cws, cyrsonach crochw fiasagyr, na'n rohan gwdiefyr i'r fi ffyr siach coer, be ffaithgyw hen sa glanile, yn tef o lan, jefrysgyw chorach, a chwyr lasar na dyfririn. Sna mych ein ysglohoch hyn gyrdana fa mi un ysyn. Something I didn't know about myself. Fishing the internet for facts, I caught an opinion, pen-named, saying that Black Angus was a bit of a Don Juan in his youth. Which wasn't what my mirror showed, but soft, pale surfeit. Why don't you hang a beard in it? If the secret voice had been true, not kind, it would say, look at yourself in the other glass, so full of the golden delirium that inflamed your words. And in my own cloudy memory, I was bold enough in that one. I remind myself of an occasion when the two great Scottish poets, Norman Macaig and Sorley MacLean, were reading together the same event. And Norman may have done his stuff, it doesn't matter which in order, but Sorley was up leafing through his book. And Norman turned to his neighbour and said, and rather, they were both a bit hard of hearing by this time, so everyone in that room except Sorley heard Norman say, I knew Sorley was going to read, but I thought he was going to read aloud. So whenever I find myself shuffling through the pages, I think, oh dear. Actually, go back to Forbidden Fruit, a reminiscence from my school days. In the English education system, I think your method of physical punishment was the cane, but in Scotland it was the belt, a three-pronged affair that kind of curled itself around your fingers. So there's a kind of reference to it in this Forbidden Fruit. And it's our little primary school in Uig and Skye. You went down the track from the school to the main road, and there was a stream with quite steep banks just immediately past. There was a bridge. And on either bank, there were hazel trees, which in due course ripened and provided nuts. But they were disapproved of by our Free Kirk elder headmaster. Having mentioned, part of the difficulty with these situations is you have conversations with people beforehand, and then you think, have I mentioned this earlier in the performance, or was it beforehand? Because I have said on many occasions through my adult life, I didn't just have the bugger 5 days a week, I had him six, because he was not only a church elder in the Free Church, which my family adhered to, but he was also the superintendent of the Sunday school, our local primary school headmaster, and he was one of those people for whom 10 commandments were not enough. There was an 11th. Thou shalt not enjoy thyself. Correction. Thou shalt not enjoy enjoying thyself. Give it an extra twist. And we did allow ourselves a little bit of enjoyment when the hazelnuts were ripe, as best we could. Forbidden fruit. The biggest nut and sweetest to the eye is on the lowest branch that reaches out above the mossy waterfall. You see it clearly from the bridge and try to count each handhold down with one eye on the schoolhouse, lest the granite eye be watching you. We'll climb down after school, you say. How sweet that nut was just about to be when, from the bridge, a black-browed roar sprayed out and fell like barbed wire net about our startled heads, and how our fingers tingled with the leathered pain we knew would follow in the morning. But even worse, to see the nut we'd had to throw away sink down into that deep, dark pool below the mossy waterfall. Glam Fatimach. Plain at Altarsin co arts in the clunery, long with Orsias and Kuan, nach Fatimach her fadja, Kutjent Hul, a shul, is a shul, Savalisho, Canilis a shul, a canoeuer, Sna clachen a rain palachin, a dolling harn. Glen remote. Plain crossing so high it can't be heard, ship going down the ocean, far out on the horizon, a part of the world travelling, travelling. In this village, people only travel once, and the stones that made walls become cairns. Ha garic bio, marchainachin ir catlin mod. There was a wonderful Irish poet, sadly no longer with us. She died quite young, cancer took her. And Kathleen Maud, not a terribly Irish name, but she was one of the great Gaelic poets of her generation. And I had the privilege of meeting her on a number of occasions. But this is a memorial, in memoriam, Kathleen Maud. Ha Gaelic bio, Gaelic is alive. Could me gendarna tuv, oper and land you, gentiles, or you post the bail in the Ha Gaelic bio, how ganyan kachsayat, si strepen at sheehan, fur and darich for hachlish, a sul and dulanach, a sheenuk, a fari fatas, si shiru, na fari fatas, lasser vuan, yekach, na proloch, narin a cavis surda crabras, ach gentiles, she oper a hound, the vitaunse. Gaelic is alive. In memoriam, Kathleen Maud. Let's put aside today's work and dance to the winds push the bale. Gaelic is alive, despite all arrows. She climbs the hillside, sapling of oak in her arms, her defiant eyes reaching the far-off horizon. She aims for the far-off horizon, a bright, lasting star in her breast. Defend her from too bold a leap, but be dancing, it is work to be dancing. In my generation, you know, as I said, I went to school, monoglot Gael was introduced to English, and that became the language of authority for the rest of, well, basically the rest of my educational life, if you like. When I went to Glasgow University, I think, as I recall, our Gaelic department lecturers lectured to us in English. But our son, by contrast, speaks Gaelic to his dad because he went to Gaelic medium school in Edinburgh. We started a campaign several years ago now decades ago, in fact, to introduce Gaelic, firstly in nurseries and then in primary schools, and now there are Gaelic medium secondary schools. The language is still on the brink of extinction in numerical terms, but we live in hope. We've got a couple of minutes left. 1 minute left. Is the clock slow? It says two. Anyway, I'll finish with this Seachán Camas. This is the bay. Seachán Camas, ferver tavri ein, a kosach na genech grehel, gwe mahanus na korrigrich, a galtin vi pesach na tuhich, rigobi aun kuna hyach, get a bound gun laga haru. Seachán Camas, ferver tavri ein, a conotrug like gilibridges fulak, a castle warp erebs agus cartus, na hil miarli na madu, Skrisug na lochtug, ach vi garg min kruhan aljach. Seachán Camas, ferver tavri ein, a chesuir geneich grehel, Kronen an a kochjolri monover na min chamak, gam fadjachu ag djerug shlia, lienug no traug. Seachán Camas, tralich a chuanyu miskin hur, yever achgun agus ornit, kailtin a kehtu, yever aljach na leeg miskin lohi aulich. Chen klesse vi fushnach, chilig agus a chilig an a chamish, tort urm an ianli, vi chilig sa chilig, lorog piashtis a chlatich, kor na kulira. This is the bay. This is the bay where peace is to be found, walking the genial sand, begging the heron's forgiveness, promising good behaviour in her territory, and being there uninvited, though transgressing no law. This is the bay where peace is to be found, addressing oyster catcher and gull, inviting their trust and friendship, intending no crime, plunder or wounding, but to observe their graceful beauty. This is the bay where peace is to be found, standing on the genial sand, humming in harmony with the murmur of ripples, welcoming them at journey's end, flow or ebb. This is my bay, the ocean's flotsam among the wrack, finding tool and ornament, lost or discarded, finding gigo or jewel among tangled putrescence. The trick is to be patient, returning and returning to the bay, respecting the birds there, to return and return, find the wealth of the shore, the ocean's surplus. Tapley, thank you.